alim al-ghayb, what we call the unseen, we have to believe in that. That's why the Quran says ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ, and then the Quran class says الَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ, those who believe in the unseen. There's an aspect of Islam that Allah wants from me and you, is that to believe in the unseen. That's it. Don't question it. Believe there's a God. Believe there's angels. Believe there's things. Don't question them. That's part of your belief. Actually, it's a test to begin with. To believe in something that you have not seen, you have not touched. So a soul is one of these things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He spoke about in the Quran, is the, you know, the is the core where the person feels pain and suffering and at the same time happiness and joy. It's the soul that will be punished in the grave, it's the soul that will be resurrected, it's the soul that will be questioned, the soul that will be either enters heaven or hell. No, but the body will die and will get decomposed in the grave.
Yes.
So it's all the soul. So what is the soul? I don't know. It's part of my belief and I believe in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
An atheist, on the other hand, he says, look, it's just a body dies and that's it. Like I said, call consciousness, call it whatever you like. There's nothing there. So it's very hard to explain something that you don't know what it is. It's more like just a submission. That's why Islam, one of the meaning of Islam is to submit.
Yes.
Aslama,
yes.
Right? That's it.
Isn't it
up.
Similar to the idea or the concept of God himself?
Which one?
Like the definition, because you can't basically define God.
Exactly, so you can't define God.
As you can't
God.
Define the soul.
Exactly. You can't, there are a lot of things in life, not just God, like a lot of concepts, like air. What is
yes.
air? We don't know what air is, but we know it's there. Like frequencies, waves. We don't know, you know, we know they exist. We don't know what they are, right? Like, I mean, not but, scientifically to give a definition of them, but how do they, how their form? We don't
but
know.
Scientists can verify, for example, and analyze the air into oxygen, hydrogen, and the stuff like that, right?
Mm.
But God is something that cannot be divisible, right?
Exactly. So God cannot be visible, cannot be defined, right? So the soul is not visible, cannot be defined. I cannot define it because I don't know what it is. But all we know is, even an atheist would agree to this, that the body, once it dies, something leaves it. That's why it's just not operating anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? You want to call it consciousness? Call
yes.
it consciousness. That's from your belief. From
yes.
my belief, I call it soul.
I see.
And then we don't, you know, we agree to disagree at the end of the day.
I see.
But how do I define to them? Like I said, if the Quran says you will not know, then I give up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah, and thank you very much, Brother Hussein. This is the end of this episode. We were talking about or criticizing the movie Replicas on the subject of cloning in this program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, signing off.
In the limelight. A Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding that he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Adam Gabbat. The piece is titled, Trump Supporter Sentenced to 8 Months in Prison for Role in Capitol Riot. Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding after he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. Paul Hodgkins was filmed wearing a Trump 2020 T-shirt with a flag over his shoulder and eye goggles around his neck, and seen taking a selfie with a self-described shaman in a horned helmet and other rioters and the days behind him. He is the first rioter to be sentenced for a felony crime in connection with the attack, which saw hundreds of Trump supporters storm the Capitol building after they were fed lies about election fraud, causing Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden. More than 570 people have been charged with taking part in the riot, during and after which 5 people died. Prosecutors had asked for Paul Hodgkins to serve 18 months, saying in a court filing he, like each rioter, contributed to the collective threat to democracy by forcing lawmakers to temporarily abandon their certification of Joe Biden's election victory and to scramble for shelter. Speaking in court in Washington, D.C. on Monday, 19th of July, Paul Hodgkins apologized and said he was ashamed of his behavior. Reading from a prepared text, he described being caught up in euphoria as he walked through Washington, then followed a crowd of hundreds up to Capitol Hill and into the Capitol building itself. If I had any idea that the protest would escalate the way it did, I would never have ventured further than the sidewalk of Pennsylvania Avenue, Hodgkins told the U.S. District Judge Randolph Moss. He added, "This was a foolish decision on my part." District Judge Randolph Moss said Hodgkins had actively and intentionally participated in an attack that threatened democracy itself, BuzzFeed reported. District Judge Randolph Moss also said Americans needed to be aware that assaulting the Capitol will have severe consequences. "The court here had to consider both what I think are extremely damaging events that occurred that day, but also who Mr. Hodgkins is as an individual," Judge Moss said. "And as I think is reflected by the sentencing I imposed, I tried to strike a balance." Hodgkins' sentence could influence other defendants as they decide whether to accept plea deals or go to trial. He and others are accused of serious crimes but were not indicted, as others were, for roles in larger conspiracies. Lawyer for Paul Hodgkins had asked District Judge Randolph Moss not to impose a prison sentence, saying the shame that would attach to Hodgkins for the rest of his life should be factored in. "Whatever punishment the court may provide will pale in comparison to the scarlet letter Mr. Hodgkins will wear for the rest of his life," Patrick N. LeDuc wrote in a court filing, citing a Nathaniel Hawthorne novel in which a woman accused of adultery is forced to wear the letter A. The filing argued that Hodgkins' conduct was not markedly different from those of Anna Morgan Lloyd, other than stepping onto the Senate floor. Anna Morgan Lloyd, a 49-year-old from Indiana, was the first of roughly 500 arrested to be sentenced. She pleaded guilty to misdemeanor, disorderly conduct, and last month was sentenced to 3 years probation. Hodgkins was not accused of assaulting anyone or damaging property. Prosecutors said he deserved some leniency for taking responsibility almost immediately and pleading guilty to obstruction, which carries a maximum 20-year prison sentence. But they also noted how he boarded a bus in his hometown of Tampa, Florida, bound for a Donald Trump rally, carrying rope, protective goggles, and latex gloves in a backpack, saying that showed he came to Washington prepared for violence. On 6th of January, he walked through grounds littered with smashed police barriers and broken windows, passing police officers and others injured as a crowd surged towards the Capitol building, prosecutors said. Time and time again, rather than turn around and retreat, Paul Hodgkins pressed forward, the government said. Some reacted with incredulity and outrage at what they saw as a lenient sentence and in some cases bias, especially compared with situations such as in Texas, where a black woman from Fort Worth, Crystal Mason, was sentenced to 5 years in prison after being convicted of illegally voting, even though she didn't know she was ineligible to vote when she went to the polls in 2016. And another case of a Texan, Hervis Rogers, who now faces the possibility of a stiff sentence after being declared ineligible to vote because he was on parole and had waited in line for 7 hours.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: characteristics of unbelievers in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, we all are believers. Alhamdulillah, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we all believe in one Allah and His religion, Islam. Now, the question is, why are we discussing the characteristics of unbelievers then? Well, today we're going to go over a couple of them because it's important for us to know that sometimes, unconsciously, and unknowingly, we end up acting as if we are unbelievers. Okay? So when we talk about these things, it stays fresh in our mind and we stay on alert that we are not going to fall for this trap of shaitan and, unfortunately, or God forbid, start acting like an unbeliever. So one of the characteristics of unbelievers in Islam is denying Allah's grace and mercy. Most unbelievers actually know the greatness and the power of Allah. They also enjoy every grace that is given by Allah, every ni'mat and every blessing given by Allah. However, they always deny that Allah who gives that grace. They do not admit and accept the presence and the control and the authority of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah said in the Quran, in chapter An-Nahl, which is chapter 16, verse number 83, they know the graces of Allah, however, then they deny it, and most of them are unbelievers. See how important it is for us to be hopeful about Allah and not become hopeless about Allah. And we cannot be a denier of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These are the things that as a believer we need to make sure that are very obvious and apparent in our existence. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about the characteristics of unbelievers in Islam. And we said we're discussing it so we can learn a lesson, we can take a lesson and not fall for the traps of shaitan. In our everyday lives, we have to be very careful and conscious of the fact that there are certain attributes that are for unbelievers only. We said one of them is worshipping other than Allah. One of them is refusing Islamic jurisprudence and Sharia and the commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The third one that we covered is denying Allah's grace and mercy. And now we're going to talk about the last one today. It is loving the world and forgetting the hereafter. Brothers and sisters, unbelievers also really love the world and forget the afterlife. Even most of them do not believe in the afterlife. Therefore, most of the world's products, such as entertainment, are mostly filled with unbelievers. And this is one of the ways to bring down Muslims. As chapter 30 of Holy Quran in verse 7 says, they only know what was born from the life of the world, while about the afterlife, they are neglectful. So brothers and sisters, as a believer, we're not ever, ever going to let our hereafter out of our sight and out of our mind. It is something that we should always be attentive towards, the afterlife. This life is a temporary life or a temporary abode, this world is. And we're going to get through it to get to that afterlife, which is eternal in nature. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Today.
The Iranian president, a sacrificial lamb or chief executive running the country. Media and experts opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran tend to display the presidency as a formality and the president as a facade to an actually totalitarian system of governance. But is the president actually a disposable entity? An individual to be blacklisted and sacrificed once his presidential term comes to an end? A scapegoat to have all the country's woes blamed on? Our experts today explain why some may believe so or claim to believe so, when in fact presidents are kept quite close to leadership even after their terms run out. Do stay with us to hear out the experts. First impressions leave a mark. Iran's first president, Abolhassan Banisadr, economist and politician, was appointed in 1980 and dismissed and wanted for treason in 1981. But he had touched a sensitive nerve, finally, which was wanting to negotiate with a terror group that later attacked Iran alongside Ba'athist Iraq. That would be the MKO. He was not a typical case, however. Mr. Abdullah Abdullahi is a media man with a comprehensive view of current affairs in context and against background. He shares his views freely to match the question. He received us at Tasnim News Agency, where he writes.
One of the distinguishing features of the Iranian political system is that it has been able to control power well. That is, the Islamic Republic has proven that it can confront the intoxicating feeling of being in power and restrain the politicians in that sense. This management of power is an important term in political systems. When a political system is being established, one of the most complicated questions and challenges is how to restrain that power. That is to be given to a person or an institution so that they perform within specific bounds and transfer the power when necessary.
Mr. Mehdi Nourai came to Press TV Studios from the Constitutional Council's Research Center to share with us his exacting knowledge of the law with regard to the president and leaders' authorities and how they've manifested in practice. Why do foreign media tend to paint a pale, ineffective picture of Iran's presidency?
Basically, because they don't want the Islamic Republic to develop and make progress, the foreigners try to target the pillars of power in Iran, cast doubt about it by encouraging speculation about elections, about their reliance on people's votes, about self-confidence, independence, confidence in countries' internal capabilities, and the use of Iran's scientific capacities. Issues, including our nuclear program, which has been the culmination of scientific and technical advancements made by the young people in our country, are being targeted by foreigners.
Then again, the highest authority in the country not being the president might give the impression his hands are tied beside a leader and commander of all armed forces and powers. Except the leader is not known to exert his influence irrationally in foreign affairs. A sensitive matter to him, actually, as someone who has expressed categorical mistrust for the U.S. That would be Ayatollah Khamenei.
مهمترین و مؤثرترین مدیریت کشور ریاست جمهوری است. اینی که حالا بعضیا میگن رئیس جمهور اختیار چند ساله که از این حرفا گاهی کنار گوشه زده میشه. رئیس جمهور اختیاراتی نداره، رئیس جمهور تدارکات چیست، رئیس جمهور 12% 15% چجوری هم محاسبه میکنن من نمیدونم. اختیارات داره. اینا همش خلاف واقعه. یا از روی بیمسئولیتی گفته میشه یا از روی بی اطلاعی گفته میشه یا خدای نکرده قرض‌ورزی در کار هست. اینجوری نیست. رئیس جمهور یکی از پرمشغله ترین و پرمسئولیت ترین دستگاه هاست، یعنی یکی از نمیشه گفت از همه مدیریت های کشور رئیس جمهور پرمشغله تر و پر مسئولیت تر این هاست.
رهبری
The leader is in a sense a policymaker and an observer at the highest level of how the goals of the system are being achieved. As described by the preamble of Constitution, the leader's role is to keep the system on its original Islamic path. There might be an administration whose policies aren't in line with that of the leader, meaning that the leader would adopt different positions if he were to take the helm. But because people cast their ballots for that administration and preferred its stance, the leader allows the cabinet to follow its goals so far as they agree with the Constitution.
دولت بر اساس قانون آنچرا که مورد توجهش بوده دنبال میکنه. ببین
Look, Hashemi's government was a specific one, with its particular orientations, behaviors, and management type. Mr. Khatami's cabinet was a polar opposite to its predecessor. People felt Mr. Khatami's government was the exact opposite of that of Mr. Hashemi and voted for him. The same goes for Mr. Ahmadinejad's government. Mr. Rouhani's administration also opposed Mr. Ahmadinejad's policies. If it were true that the presidents take ceremonial positions, we wouldn't witness such disparity in opinions and performances among the governments during all these years.
For a better understanding of roles of power and their extension, let's put faces to them by introducing presidents that have come and gone since Iran's millennia-old monarchy fell with the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Presidents' backgrounds, that is, and what became of them after their governance. Governing institutions will also be touched upon in today's episode. I'll begin with the leader, however, who was himself president when the Assembly of Experts selected him to replace Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, first leader of the Islamic Republic, upon his demise 10 years since the revolution. Now 81, the then young cleric Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the early 1960s joined the religious opposition movement of Ayatollah Khomeini against the king or Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1979, when the revolution happened, he served on the Revolutionary Council, which ruled alongside the interim government. He subsequently became Deputy Defense Minister and helped organize the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Sayyid Ali Khamenei did not become president right after Abul Hassan Bani Sadr. The second president was Muhammad Ali Rajai, who was short-lived in years and professionally. It was after his assassination that Sayyid Ali Khamenei ascended to the presidency, a presidency that continued by promotion to leadership, the highest position in the country. Already an ardent advocate of the concept of velayat-e-faqih, that's governance by the religious jurist, Sayyid Ali Khamenei was among the founding members of the IRP, that's the Loyalist Islamic Republican Party. In 1981, when the IRP's upper ranks were shattered by a series of bombings that killed the party's Secretary General and President Rajai, Ayatollah Khamenei had himself gotten paralyzed in the right arm, but was promoted to IRP Secretary General. And within weeks, he became the IRP's candidate for the presidency and was elected to succeed Rajai. At the time, the presidency was largely ceremonial and with the greater power vested in the Prime Minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi, at the time. Our guest explains why the presidency in Iran is more complex and challenging than other countries at large.
The first thing to take into account is how the political system looks, what the mechanisms are, what form the institutions take, and how it formulates the political order. They aren't to be taken as gospel. For instance, there might be a presidency or a chancellorship, such as what we see in Germany. There are countries, including the UK, that have a prime minister. The US, France, and Germany all have their way of running the country. There are disparate forms of political systems among the countries that claim to be democratic. The fact that they differ in their form doesn't mean they're necessarily anti-democratic or have imposed specific constraints on democracy.
From what you say, the leader minimally interferes in the president's affairs. So why is Iran painted as a totalitarian system?
Speaking of totalitarian regimes, one of their key characteristics is that they don't observe the rule of law, or that they're oppressive toward their people and depend on foreigners. These are characteristics that have been mentioned in constitutional books. They don't depend on the people. This is why the Islamic Republic of Iran has held nearly 44 elections over the 42 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. And that's not counting midterm elections. If we include them too, the figure will rise over 200 elections. The lowest turnout in Iran's election has been the highest figure in other countries' elections. If we consider this, we'll see that the Islamic Republic has always stressed the importance of people's role. Article 177 of the Constitution has made this principle basically irrevocable. That's why the characteristics of the Islamic Republic can never be compared to these totalitarian regimes that don't observe the rule of law.
در عمل
بیشترین نقش رو برای مردم خواسته.
Now as leader, what differences might have occurred with presidents that have succeeded him and served under his leadership? Mohammad Khatami, a reformist, was president from 1997 to 2005. He pushed for détente with the West and more social and political freedom in Iran. After two terms, the maximum length in office, he was succeeded by conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Khatami was with Ahmadinejad's rival, former and last prime minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi at the time. That's during the events of 2009, which led to Mousavi's house arrest. Ms. Zohra Elahian is an MP and on the Parliamentary Committee for National Security and Foreign Policy. So we made the trek down to Parliament to hear her views on all matters presidential.
Unfortunately, two of the presidential candidates in 2009 voiced their objections outside the legal norm, which led to chaos and crisis in the country and endangered the national security and the interests of the people. The main problem was that the two candidates didn't respect the country's legal structure. They didn't pursue their objection to the election result through its legal course and try to draw people on the streets, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the complaints and electoral process can be legally reviewed. But unfortunately, these candidates didn't choose the legal path and issued provocative statements to bring people on the streets.
Yet Khatami was invited to join the Expediency Council as a member, but he declined the offer. He never gave up political activity, however. His activity was extensive since 1988. He has in fact been considered the reason for Mr. Rouhani's victory in the presidential elections of 2013 and 2017. To fall back into sequencing, Mohammad Khatami was succeeded by a conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Tehran mayor. He was seen by some as a protege of Ayatollah Khamenei, but he faced mounting criticism over his government's management of the economy and foreign policy decisions. And finally, he fell out with the leader after reportedly trying to increase his own powers to ends not favorable to the leadership. He still remains in office. His two terms ended 8 years ago, but to this day he remains in the Expediency Council, a high body advising the leader. I asked, why would you say some Iranian presidents change course after their term or when it's coming to a close?
Unfortunately, it's possible for some presidents who have the experience of being in office for 4 or 8 years to not obtain a clear understanding of the country's legal and political system, or they might receive wrong advice, so they might depart from the legal path. We saw the example in 2009 when this lack of proper understanding of the political and legal system and ignoring the national interest and security created crises and challenges in the country, which cost the people some damage. It basically goes back to the president and the advice he receives.
Why have some of our presidents taken a different route once they finished with their presidency or towards the end of their terms?
به هر حال اون دو سال پایانی وقتی که دولت‌ها بر سر کار هستن.
Anyhow, in the last 2 years of a government's terms, such issues might occur because of several reasons. One is that they're coming closer to their end of the term in office and see themselves less reliant on the people's support. They even find themselves less in need of support from the political system. At the same time, they want to stay at the highest possible level of power after leaving office.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was succeeded in 2013 by now outgoing President Hassan Rouhani, who after two terms in office, like most before him, will be handing down his responsibilities to President-elect Ebrahim Raisi in early August. Now, Rouhani's office has been interesting, both lauded and lamented at the same time. It's interesting to see where he will land. But during office, he negotiated the landmark nuclear deal, the JCPOA, with world powers. Although warned against trusting the U.S. by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader still gave him his blessing and go ahead with the deal.
در نظر داشته باشیم که اختیاراتی که قانون اساسی به رئیس جمهور داده.
Keep in mind that the powers conferred on the president by the constitution are specified in Article 113, which specifies executive powers of the leader, which is very brief, and as stated by Article 110, all other powers go to the president. In line with this, making decisions about the country's revenue, based on Article 52 of the Constitution, is with the government, which is headed by the president. It's the president who determines how the revenue is spent. That's specified in the budget bill, which is presented by the government, headed by the president.
Now, talking of sequencing, an important link was left out. That would be President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who, like the early building blocks of the revolution, is associated with the IRP and Revolutionary Council. He was the two-term president before President Khatami and after the once president Khamenei. I left him out, as his office in those earlier days of the revolution is not associated with the matter of how much the leader may have exerted influence on his decision-making. Mind you, he did look to reducing Iran's international isolation by reviewing ties with Europe. This would be part of a greater strategy to use foreign investment and free enterprise to boost the country's war-torn economy. We are talking the eight-year Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s. And domestically, he implemented family planning policies to reverse policies that would lead to population growth. This was against the background of a very principalist establishment and leadership. Not to forget, Rafsanjani was instrumental in preparing the conditions for President Khamenei to succeed the then-leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Rafsanjani, despite all the differences of opinion in the fields of foreign policy and production and industry, with some principalists and reformists, remained in high positions, such as chairman of the Expediency Council and chairman of the Assembly of Leadership Experts.
The late Rafsanjani has long been one of the key figures in the Islamic Revolution and an important figure in the political arena in the country. But at some point, unfortunately, some of the positions and actions were somewhat at odds with the views of the leader of the Islamic Republic. However, the leader always wanted to avoid rifts from being created between the officials, especially between himself and Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, and always tried to manage the situation to prevent that rift from taking shape.
I've pointed more or less to the backgrounds of the President and Prime Minister Mousavi. To put in a little more where I've left it thin, Mir Hossein Mousavi, architect, painter, intellectual and politician, served as Iran's Prime Minister from 1981 to 1989, and afterwards as presidential advisor from 1989 to 2005. That's advisor to two prominent presidents, Rafsanjani and Khatami. He was a member of various councils and assemblies for many years after being the prime minister, and his consultations were put to use. Even after the events of 2009, the system did not try him, but put him under siege. Mousavi's marvel during premiership was that he managed to control the inflation and ensure the reliable availability of essential items during the long-drawn imposed war with Iraq. He served as a member on the Expediency Council and Council of Guardians, now known as the Constitutional Council. Khatami, during the 1960s and 70s, gained a reputation as an opponent of the rule of the Shah. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he was elected to the Majlis, or Parliament, and later became Minister of Culture twice. In 1997, he won a landslide presidential victory with almost 70% of the vote by an electorate looking for more socio-political freedom and an open economy inviting foreign investment.
The presidency in Iran is somehow more sensitive in that.
A significant number of powerful governments in the world are trying to create hurdles for this key post in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this way, the presidency is more serious, special, and unique compared to the same post or its equivalent chancellorship or premiership in other countries. But in terms of its internal reality, it's like any other political system. The president has the highest executive powers in the country and is carrying out his duties.
I mentioned high councils former presidents have found themselves in to continually put in practice their experiences gained during presidency. To clarify, the Expediency Council is an advisory body for the leader with an ultimate adjudicating power in disputes over legislation between the parliament and the Guardian Council or Constitutional Council. The leader appoints its members from among prominent religious, social, and political figures. In October 2005, he gave the Expediency Council supervisory powers over all branches of government. The Assembly of Experts for the Leadership is an 88-member body of Islamic jurists, elected once every 8 years by direct popular vote. Their mandate by constitution is to appoint, monitor, and possibly dismiss the leader. Candidacy for this council depends on approval by the Constitutional Council, a 12-member body appointed by the leader and parliament, as well as being an Islamic jurist.
معمولاً از تجربه رؤسای جمهور در مجمع تشخیص مصلحت.
Usually, the Expediency Council enlists the help of the previous presidents. This council can bring different branches of the government together and resolve the differences between the president and the parliament and offer advice to the leader about the general policies of the system. This is an important position where previous presidents play a role, but some presidents have been left outside due to their weak performance. It's only natural for a president who's been in office for many years but doesn't have a clear understanding of the political and legal structure and whose performance has harmed the public and national security to be left aside. It's better that he is limited so he can't do further damage to the national interests and the security.
Since so many of the said positions are filled by election, allow me to say where national elections are held. They're held to decide on a president, members of parliament, assembly of experts members, and city and village councillors. Parliament or Majlis has 290 members currently, elected for a 4-year term in multi- and single-seat constituencies. Ms. Elahian believes the importance of elections is undisputed, unquestionable.
The fact that different media are focusing their attention on Iran's president proves that it's a very important political and executive position in the country and is far from ceremonial. That's why the media are focusing on this issue, which is also being talked about on an international scale. The other point is that the presidents have to be responsible for their performance both during their term and after they leave office. This is because the management of the significant portion of the country, its structure and budget, is given to the president and his team, and he enjoys the powers that people grant him by their votes. The president and his ministers have to be responsible for the power given to them during the 4 or 8 years in office.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after for a dip into any manner of matters Iranian or a visit to any personality or walk of life. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime secretly authorized a group of cyber surveillance firms to work for Saudi Arabia, despite international condemnation of the kingdom's abuse of surveillance software to crush dissent, even after the Saudi killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ronan Bergman and Mark Mazzetti, journalists. This article is published under the heading Zionist Regime Companies Aided Saudi Spying Despite Khashoggi Killing. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime secretly authorized a group of cyber surveillance firms to work for Saudi Arabia regime, despite international condemnation of the kingdom's abuse of surveillance software to crush dissent, even after the Saudi killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Zionist regime encouraged NSO and two other companies to continue working with Saudi Arabia and issued a new license for a fourth to do similar work, overriding any concerns about human rights abuses. Since then, Saudi Arabia has continued to use the spyware to monitor dissidents and political opponents. The fact that the Zionist regime has encouraged its private companies to do security work for the kingdom is yet more evidence of the reordering of traditional alliances in the region and the strategy by the Israeli regime and several Persian Gulf countries to join forces. NSO is by far the best known of the Israeli regime firms, largely because of revelations in the last few years that its Pegasus program was used by numerous regimes to spy on and eventually imprison human rights activists. NSO sold Pegasus to Saudi Arabia regime in 2017. The kingdom used the spyware as part of a ruthless campaign to crush dissent inside the kingdom and to hunt down Saudi dissidents abroad. It is not publicly known whether Saudi Arabia used Pegasus or other Israeli regime-made spyware in the plot to kill Khashoggi. NSO has denied that its software was used. The Zionist regime's Ministry of War also licensed for Saudi work a company called Candiro, which Microsoft accused last week of helping its regime clients spy on more than 100 journalists, politicians, dissidents, and human rights advocates around the world. Microsoft, which conducted its investigation in tandem with Citizen Lab, a research institute at the University of Toronto, said Candiro had used malware to exploit a vulnerability in Microsoft products, enabling its regime clients to spy on perceived enemies. Candiro has had at least one contract with Saudi Arabia regime since 2018. The Zionist regime has also granted licenses to at least two other firms, Variant, which was licensed before the Khashoggi killing, the Quadrim, which signed a contract with Saudi Arabia after the killing. A fifth company, Celebrite, which manufactures physical hacking systems for mobile phones, has also sold its services to the Saudi regime, but without ministry approval, according to the newspaper Haaretz. The Zionist regime war ministry declined to respond to specific questions about the licenses it gave to the Israeli firms, but said that a wide range of security, diplomatic, and strategic considerations are taken into account when considering whether to grant a license to export offensive cyber technology. Revelations about the abuses of NSO products led the company to hire a group of outside consultants in 2018 to provide advice about which new clients NSO should take on and which to avoid. The group included Daniel Shapiro, the former Obama administration ambassador to the occupied territories, and Beacon Global Strategies, a Washington strategic consulting firm. Beacon is led by Jeremy Bash, a former CIA and Pentagon chief of staff, Michael Allen, a former staff director for the House Intelligence Committee, and Andrew Shapiro, a former top State Department official. While the group's mandate was to vet potential new clients, the international outrage over Khashoggi's killing in October 2018 led the group to advise NSO to cancel its Saudi contracts and shut down NSO systems in the kingdom. Separately, NSO conducted an internal investigation into whether any of its tools were used by Saudi regime officials for the Khashoggi operation and concluded that they were not. However, a lawsuit against NSO by a friend of Khashoggi's claim that his phone had been hacked by the Saudi Arabia regime using Pegasus, and that hack gave Saudi officials access to his conversations with Khashoggi, including communications about opposition projects. Over several days in late 2018, executives both of NSO and the private equity firm that owned it at the time, Francisco Partners, met in Washington with the advisory group. According to several people familiar with the meetings, the NSO executives argued that the Israeli regime was strongly encouraging the company to weather the storm and continue its work in Saudi Arabia. They also said that the Israeli officials had indicated to them that the Trump administration also wanted NSO's work with Saudi Arabia to continue. In the end, NSO management heeded the advice of the outside group and canceled its contracts with Saudi Arabia in late 2018. Mr. Shapiro, the former ambassador to the occupied territories, ended his work for the company shortly afterward. Months later, however, after another private equity firm bought NSO, the company was once again doing business with Saudi Arabia regime. NSO's new owner, Noval Pina, rejected the advice of the outside advisory group, and NSO resumed its work in Saudi Arabia in mid-2019. Around that time, Beacon ended its work with NSO. The new contract with the Saudis came with some restrictions. For example, NSO set up its system to block any attempt by Saudi officials to hack European telephone numbers, according to a person familiar with the programming. But it is clear that Saudi Arabia has continued to use NSO software to spy on perceived opponents abroad. In one case that has come to light, 36 phones belonging to journalists at Al Jazeera, which Saudi Arabia considers a threat, were hacked using NSO's Pegasus software last year, according to Citizen Lab. Citizen Lab traced 18 of the attacks back to Saudi intelligence. After the revelation of the attack on Al Jazeera journalists, NSO recently shut down the system, and at a meeting in early July, the company's board decided to declare new deals with Saudi Arabia off-limits, according to a person familiar with the decision. The Zionist regime's war ministry is currently fighting lawsuits by Israeli rights activists demanding that it release details about its process for granting the licenses. The Israeli regime also imposes a strict secrecy on the companies that receive the licenses, threatening to revoke them if the companies speak publicly about the identity of their clients. An NSO statement said the company could not discuss the identity of its customers, but added, as NSO has previously stated, our technology was not associated in any way with the heinous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. This includes listening, monitoring, tracking, or collecting information, unquote. Officials with Candiro variant and regime of Saudi Arabia declined to comment. Officials with Quadrim could not be reached. These business ties came as the Zionist regime was quietly building relationships directly with the Saudi regime. Benjamin Netanyahu, then Israeli regime's prime minister, met several times with Saudi Arabia's day-to-day ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and military and intelligence leaders of the two regimes meet frequently. While Saudi Arabia was not officially party to the Abraham Accords, the diplomatic initiatives during the end of the Trump administration normalizing relations between Israeli regime and several Arab regimes, Saudi leaders worked behind the scenes to help broker the deals.
IRIB English Radio presents Month of Velaya. The Velaya of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Welcome to the program Month of Velaya. When we talk about Velayat, we understand that Velayat is actually the authority of God that he has over the entire creation. And that because he has sent for us perfect human beings, and those human beings are his representatives, and they inform us of the way that God will become pleased, the way that he will become displeased with us. When we look at some of the traditions, we actually find a deeper and a more comprehensive meaning of walayat. In one of the traditions in Basair al-Darajat, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam was asked about the goodly tree in the Quran. They asked him, what is this goodly tree, which is in verse 14, Surah Ibrahim, verse 24. Imam alayhi salam tells him that this tree that is in the Quran has a meaning, and the meaning is this, is that it's base, and that its branches, its roots, its base is the Holy Prophet, and its branches are Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And that this tree, this how trees have twigs. The twigs are the Imams alayhi salam. Then the tree has fruit, and the fruit is the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And then a tree has leaves in it. And what are those leaves? Those leaves are me and you and all the, inshallah, all the believers and all the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. So that we are one tree, we are one body, that we are connected no matter where we live. If you live in a faraway land, far away from believers, you should know that you're connected. You're connected to the Imams, you're connected to the Holy Prophet of Islam. And that is walayat. That is the beauty of walayat. When we look at another tradition in Basair al-Darajat, and we look at the story of Rumaila. Rumaila was a person that had many problems. And he said to himself, let me come to the masjid and pray behind Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib so that I can, my problems will be removed. When he comes to Imam Ali, he doesn't present his problems to him. he is astonished and amazed that Imam Adi alayhi salam already knows of his problems. And then Imam Adi in the tradition clarifies for Rumaila and tells him this, tells him, Ya Rumaila, laysa min mu'minin yamradu illa maridna bimaradih. There is no person that becomes a no believer that becomes sick unless we are sick with his sickness. Meaning that when we feel ill, when we have problems, when we have difficulties, the Imams, alayhi salam, when we feel